Today is Friday, 25th May. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Claire Eagle. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia to our campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca. Thank you for being with us on this fine, sunny Monday, Friday. I'm very glad it's a Friday. I like Fridays.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Good evening. It is 5:03 and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover news from the UBC campus, local news from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. All this, plus your weekend weather forecast, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club, right here on News 101, your source for independent news. And now for your UBC campus and local headlines.
UBC has rejected a deal to buy licenses for copyrighted course content through Access Copyright, a private company based out of Toronto. By rejecting a deal reached by the Association of Universities and Colleges of Canada, AUCC, UBC now sees this as a groundbreaking move and will set up an in-house copyright office to license content. Although UBC President Stephen Toop is also the chair of the AUCC, he is strongly in support of UBC working out licensing with individual publishers rather than buying a catch-all license from the AC. According to David Ferrer, UBC Provost and Vice President Academic, the move could save UBC a substantial amount of money, up to $1 million each year. As more and more content is distributed to students electronically, rather than through photocopied course packages, Access Copyright has decided to change the way they collected money from universities. Although Access Copyright does provide licensing for a great deal of content, Ferris stated that UBC would have needed to operate its own licensing office as well, regardless of whether it signed on with AC. Ferris said, quote, Access Copyright itself only owns a subset of the material, and there are at least 180 publishers that are not part of Access Copyright. So, any university that's really doing their job should have an office that's doing individual clearances, end quote. A previous deal between UBC and AC, which ended in 2010, cost UBC $3.38 per student, plus 10 cents per printed page of content. The new agreement, which UBC decided not to stop, brought the per-student fee up to $26, but did away with the per-page fee.
The BC Liquor Store in the UBC Village is set to close, with a new location to open in Westbrook Village, across from Save-On Foods. According to Michael Paquette, development manager with the UBC Properties Trust, the new location will be 4,800 square feet and will have a significantly larger inventory than the current village location. In an email to the UBC newspaper, Vince Cornoyer of the BC Liquor Distribution Branch wrote that the UBC Village location did not meet the Liquor Distribution Branch's sales expectations and that they are moving to Westbrook Village because, quote, its location is in close proximity to a major grocery store and additional retail and commercial businesses, end quote. Cornoyer also wrote that the UBC Village store would close as soon as the new store is open. The liquor distribution branch has confirmed that the hours at the new location will unfortunately remain the same as those at the current one, 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. from Monday to Thursday and Saturday, 10 a.m. to 9 p.m. on Friday, and closed on Sunday.
After last week's enactment of Bill 78, an emergency law that grants Quebec police increased powers to arrest protesters, UBC students have begun to publicly express their feelings on the movement and organize a solidarity rally downtown, and UBC's Student Society finally took a stance on issues affecting their fellow students in Quebec. Over 200 people turned out on Tuesday at the rally in solidarity with Quebec striking students, led by UBC student Gregory Williams. Held on the steps of the Vancouver Art Gallery, the rally criticized the actions of Quebec's government against the protesting students, especially Bill 78. Williams spoke to the media as he led the protesters to march through Vancouver streets, saying, quote, "I actually think that the AMS Council's condemnation says something about how inspiring what's going on in Quebec really is, that it can spark something all the way across the country. Rising tuition, incredible debts, governments that are more invested in the corporate establishments than they are in the people, all of these issues are Canada-wide, and really, they're worldwide," end quote. As mentioned, UBC's AMS Council condemned the bill in its Wednesday meeting, with a motion criticizing its effects on student union autonomy. But rather than focusing on the issue of education access in BC, the AMS chose to focus on the most extreme aspects of Bill 78. The bill requires advance police notice for any public demonstration of over 50 people and imposes stiff fines for any student leaders deemed to be involved in a prohibited demonstration. Although an AMS council representative proposed donating $500 to a legal defense fund for the Quebec protesters, the donation was rejected. AMS Vice President External Kyle Warwick said he was afraid that the money would go toward defending those who were accused of acts of violence.
The University of British Columbia has launched major new research projects on religion and morality, terrorism and security, international relations in the digital age, free trade and sustainability, thanks to a $3.8 million in new funding from Canada's Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council, or SSHRC. Of the funding, nearly $3 million will support the world's largest study on the evolution of religion and morality. Led by UBC Faculty of Arts Professor Edward Slingerland, the six-year project, named the Cultural Evolution of Religion Research Consortium, or CERC, is the largest research project of its kind and will involve more than 50 researchers from 20 global institutions across North America, Europe, and Asia to advance our understanding of religion and its role in society. CERC is a project of UBC's Center for the Study of Human Evolution, Cognition, and Culture. Professor Slingerland's grant is the largest of the SSHRC partnership and partnership development grants announced today by Minister of State, Science and Technology, Gary Goodyear. The funding was announced at Congress 2012, Canada's annual largest meeting for humanities and social scientists, which will occur May 26th to June 2nd in Waterloo, Ontario.
Ground was broken on Thursday for the new St. John Hospice at UBC. The palliative care facility aims to provide end-of-life care for 15 patients starting next year. UBC is moving ahead with a controversial project after months of consultation with Chinese residents who live next door. The residents who oppose the facility said they cannot live beside the dying because of cultural reasons. Stephen Owen, UBC Vice President, said that, quote, "What we found in the end, through that full conversation, is that the opposition melted away," end quote. But some Chinese residents say that they are still very upset about the hospice. In addition to cultural concerns, some worry that their property value will decrease. Stephen Owen said, quote, "If property issues were a concern, we had clear studies showing that having a facility like this, if anything, enhances the value in the community and properties," end quote.
A voracious meter-long fish that may be skulking in the waters of Burnaby, BC, Pond, appears to be gaining a reputation as a slippery character. The torpedo-shaped snakehead fish, capable of snapping up mammals two-thirds its size in its wide and toothy jaw, has apparently been seen in the muddy lagoon of Central Park, but it eluded government fishermen sent to reel it in on Wednesday. Crews from the Environment Ministry, the Ministry of Forests, Lands, and Natural Resource Operations, and the City of Burnaby tried several methods, including running electric currents through a lagoon to shock all the fish and scoop up any unwelcome species. An 8-kilogram carp and several turtles have been hauled away, but there's no sign of the snakehead fish, capable of breathing oxygen and swimming short distances over land. Environment Ministry spokesman Matthias Herborg said the unsuccessful fishing trip doesn't mean the creatures aren't there, and officials will return to the lagoon in hopes of making a final determination. Snakeheads, native to freshwater in Russia and China, have few predators when fully grown and could pose a severe risk to BC's wild salmon stocks if they reach the nearby Fraser River.
A campaign against the fur industry has been brought to the front lawns of Vancouver shop owners. Vancouver police and the RCMP are searching for the vandals who coated red paint on four fur stores, three in Vancouver and one in North Vancouver. Animal rights extremist group, the Animal Liberation Front, or the ALF, claimed responsibility for the acts in a press release that said the red paint was, quote, to remind the public of the innocent blood spilled every day in the vicious fur trade. This action is dedicated to the hundreds of thousands of mink suffering and dying on the many filthy, polluted fur farms in the lower mainland, end quote. Jeremy Vlasic, a spokesperson for the ALF based out of Los Angeles, said he doesn't know the Vancouver vandals, but that their actions are necessary. He said, quote, we know that fur shops have closed after being damaged economically. That's why we're turning to these particular means, end quote.
Today saw hundreds of activists in the streets of Toronto taking part in an annual event controversially titled The Slut Walk. The event was aimed at combating sexual violence. A Vancouver version of the event was cancelled after some feminists complained that the use of the term slut was inappropriate. According to organizers, the usage of slut is meant to reappropriate the word and stand against rape culture. Regardless, organizers put less emphasis on the word slut this year because it was, divisive and, quote, contentious. The event started when a Toronto police officer told a group of York students that if they didn't want to be raped, they shouldn't, quote, dress like sluts. The movement quickly grew with marches happening all around the world, including in New Delhi, India, South Africa, Tel Aviv, Israel. Tomorrow, Brazil will play host to a national slut walk march that will take place in 20 cities.
In a bid to cut costs, Ottawa announced that it will be closing the Coast Guard station at Kitsilano, one of the busiest in Canada, after the summer's boating season. The station responded to 285 incidents in 2011 and cost $900,000 a year to run. The union representing Coast Guard employees are asking the federal government to throw the ill-fated Kitsilano station a line or risk the consequences of this decision. According to the union, employees at the Kitsilano Coast Guard station have saved 55 lives so far this year. Nine were saved this Victoria Day long weekend alone. Vancouver City Councillors Jeff Meggs, Carrie Jang and Tim Stevenson, Park Board Chair Constance Barnes, and Federal MP Finn Donnelly have thrown their support behind the Save the Kitsilano Guard Base campaign on Facebook. The city officials say the decision to scrap the station came as a complete shock to municipal and regional governments. The federal government proposes the Coast Guard station in Richmond, half an hour away by hovercraft, is capable of covering for the loss of the Kitsilano station, though the Coast Guard Union disagrees.
And those are your UBC campus and local headlines on News 101 here on CITR. We're going to take a quick break, but do stay with us for your local weather forecast, as well as your provincial and national headlines.
Menzo Nagano was the first Japanese citizen to officially immigrate to Canada. He arrived in New Westminster in 1877 as a stowaway aboard a British ship. He later relocated to Victoria, and for 35 years he worked jobs loading timber and fishing for salmon until he returned to Japan in 1922.
This PSA was brought to you in support of Asian Heritage Month by CITR 101.9.
Grammy Award winners Tedeschi Trucks Band brings their blues-inspired show to the Vancouver Centre for Performing Arts for one night, June 19th. Tickets on sale at Ticketmaster.ca or by calling 855-985-5000. Don't miss Tedeschi Trucks Band on June 19th at the Vancouver Centre for Performing Arts. For more information, go to TedeschiTrucks.com.
Well, I came to the city.
Hi, my name's Auburn. Canadian Sports Center Pacific is proud to invite you to the Sport Performance Speaker Series on Monday, May 28th at 4:30 p.m. The event is held at the Creekside Community Center in the former 2010 Athletes Village. Our topic will be sport medicine, maintaining optimal health while on the road. Our panel features local sport medicine experts, Dr. Bob McCormick, as well as physiotherapists Mark Rosardo and Wendy Epp. For more information and to register, please visit www.cscpacific.ca or call 778-327-4087. Thanks, and go Canada, go!
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
We now have your local weather forecast for the weekend, brought to you by Phil from the UBC Storm Club. Hi, Phil.
Hey, thanks for having me here. Good evening, listeners. This weekend looks to be a relatively uneventful one. Despite having a very large and well-formed low-pressure system swooping through the Yukon Territory north of us, it's so big, it's actually affecting parts of northern and central BC. But here in Vancouver, we're being safely sheltered by the rightmost end of a high-pressure system currently parked in the Pacific. So unless you're driving north of, say, Prince Rupert this weekend, the most dynamic weather should be a few hours of rain. One other thing I'd like to make a note of is how the temperature broke 20 degrees today. We've broken the double 10 mark thing. Now, from now on in this part of the year, we should be experiencing these more warmer temperatures. The norm should be around 17, 18 degrees. So, now for the three-day weekend weather forecast for UBC. Tonight, cloudy with a 20% of showers, low of 15. Saturday, we are expecting some scattered clouds, high of 17, low of 14. Sunday, overcast with a 40% chance of rain, high of 15, low of 12. So that's your three-day weekend weather forecast for UBC, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. It is currently 17 degrees on UBC campus. And reporting for News 101, I'm Phil Chang.
Thank you, Phil, for that weekend weather forecast. It is now time for your provincial and national headlines.
The case of a man charged with slaughtering 56 sled dogs 2 years ago is changing venues due to ongoing concerns over the man's safety. Robert Fawcett's lawyer appeared on his behalf in provincial court in Pemberton on Thursday, but the matter will be moved to North Vancouver on June 19th. Publicly voiced threats and inadequate security features were cited as the main concerns, especially as members of the general public have become very vocal in their opposition to Fawcett's actions. Fawcett faces one count of causing unnecessary pain and suffering to the dogs in the animal cruelty case that has drawn international attention. 56 dogs were dug up in a mass grave near Whistler after an information leak in January 2012. The animals had been a tourist draw during the 2010 Vancouver Olympics. After the slaughter, the British Columbia government brought in new protection for sled dogs, establishing legal requirements for such things as containing animals, working conditions, and euthanasia.
A U.S. oceanographer has warned that human remains could be among the debris from last year's tsunami in Japan, expected to wash up on the West Coast. Kurt Ebesmeyer, co-creator of the Ocean Surface Current Simulator computer model, spoke at a symposium in Port Angeles, Washington, earlier this week, and urged beachcombers to be respectful with the debris. The provincial government expects the majority of tsunami debris to arrive on BC shorelines in 2013, but the Tsunami Debris Coordinating Committee believes it's, quote, highly unlikely that human remains will wash ashore. According to a tsunami debris FAQ on the Ministry of Environment's website, Human remains will be handled on a case-by-case basis, with the coroner's service taking the lead. Meanwhile, volunteers are gearing up for a busy shoreline cleanup session. According to Jill Dwyer, the cleanup's director, more than 700 people have signed up for the Great Canadian Shoreline Cleanup's Tsunami Debris Registry within the last week. Volunteers removed 61,875 kilograms of litter from BC's beaches last year. Jill Dwyer said organizers don't know what to expect this year and the next as tsunami debris hits local shores. Volunteers will be told to contact local authorities if they come across any human remains.
Premier Christy Clark has decided to phase out the unpopular air care emissions testings for cars and trucks. The program took an estimated 20,000 tons of carbon dioxide out of the airshed in the Lower Fraser Valley every year. However, it was unpopular with drivers due to the time associated with the testing, as well as the $45 testing fee. The AirCare program tests most passenger vehicles as a precondition to renew vehicle insurance. Since it started in 1992, more than 2.5 million vehicles have been tested, and more than a third have failed. However, the government says that tighter emission standards on new cars have reduced the need for the program. It will be eliminated at the end of 2014. This announcement comes just days after Ms. Clark canceled a regulatory review of BC Hydro in order to impose her own quote-unquote family-friendly rate regime. Under this, electricity rates will rise significantly less than BC Hydro sought, by just 1.4% next April. This move comes as the BC Liberals face substantial drops in popularity and have been losing supporters to both the Conservatives and the NDP. In recent weeks, Clark has floated a name change for her party, launched a review of the controversial carbon tax, and recently invited the public to choose the date for the new statutory holiday, Family Day.
Documents obtained by the Vancouver Sun show that the BC government looked at the possibility of offloading surplus property owned by the University Endowments Land and the Royal BC Museum as part of its plan to sell $700 million in government assets. But on Thursday, Finance Minister Kevin Falcon said, conclusively, the government will not sell anything from the two high-profile public sector organizations, saying, quote, I can say with absolute certainty that in the case of both UBC and the museum, that there are no lands that we've identified, end quote, adding that the two entities were looked at as part of a sweeping government review. Falcon said during his 2012 budget speech that, quote, We are preparing to sell some surplus assets that sit on government's books, costing money with no return to taxpayers. We will only consider selling properties that are not currently in use, that are not earmarked for future use, and are of no strategic benefit for the government to own. End quote. On Thursday, Finance Minister Falcon said the government will not release a list of the properties because doing so would compromise the province's ability to negotiate the best price for each one.
The Ottawa Citizen has reported a new poll suggests the desire to maintain ties to the monarchy has grown in English Canada, while the royals appear to have grown less popular in Quebec. A Canadian Press Harris Decimus survey conducted between May 17th and May 20th, just before Prince Charles and Camilla make a quick Canadian visit, suggests some 51% of Canadians want to maintain the monarchy. That is a 6% increase in support for keeping the monarchy when the survey's results are compared to a similar poll conducted in 2009. In Quebec, however, just 24% say the monarchy is an important part of Canadian history, a figure that's down 6% from the previous poll. Experts say that this bump in popularity is likely due to the Conservative government's efforts to highlight Canada's links to the monarchy and the Canadian visit of Prince William and his wife Kate last summer.
And those are your provincial and national headlines on News 101 here on CITR. We're going to take a quick break, but do stay with us for your international headlines and an interview by Democracy Now!
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
listen to this in your spare time? Would you listen to this? How about this one? If you like what you hear, then check out The Rib with your host, Robin Jacob, Mondays at 4 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM.
Jazz is a word that means many different things to many different people. The best definition of jazz that I know of is the jazz show on CITR with yours truly, Gavin Walker. Monday nights, 9 to midnight, with the jazz feature at 11 o'clock. Check us out every Monday.
Welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
I'm Claire Eagle, and it is now time for your international headlines brought to you by Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. Student protests continued last night in Montreal. Witness video shows hundreds of participants marching down the street banging pots. Later in the evening, police used a controversial crowd control technique called kettling, where they surround protesters and limit their escape routes. Bystanders are often caught within the police lines. Police arrested more than 500 people, which, according to Canadian media, is the largest one-night arrest total since the protests began more than 3 months ago. Arrests were also made in other cities in the province. The Quebec government said it would resume negotiations with student leaders, but won't discuss the two main issues students are protesting, tuition hikes and a new emergency protest law that severely cracks down on demonstrations. A court in Bahrain has sentenced the daughter of famous hunger striker Abdul Hadi Al-Khawaja to 30 days in jail. Police arrested Zainab Al-Khawaja in late April during a protest of the country's Formula One race. Abdul Hadi has been on hunger strike for more than 100 days and appeared in court earlier this week. A retrial is underway in his case. Mexican authorities have arrested a man they say was responsible for the murder of U.S. independent journalist Bradley Will in 2006. Will was filming protests in Oaxaca when he was shot. Prosecutors say suspect Lennon Osorio has not been connected to either protesters or police and apparently acted alone, according to the AP. A protester had previously been arrested and jailed in the murder, but was exonerated. Many activists believe Will was shot by someone aligned with the government. Organizers of Occupy Wall Street have filed a lawsuit against New York City and the police department in Manhattan federal court. They say the city violated their rights during their eviction from Zuccotti Park last year. FSRN's Salim Rizvi reports.
The court complaint seeks nearly $50,000 in redress for the damage and destruction of books and equipment during a police raid at Zuccotti Park, where Occupy protesters camped for several months. Karanja Gashusha is one of the organizers.
We haven't seen this sort of destruction of literary information, material, books, in a long time, and especially, and not in this country before. So it is an issue of huge symbolic importance that our government seems to be so in cahoot, in concert with the 1%, that they are prepared to destroy the materials that people use to educate themselves.
The protesters say thousands of books and other materials were destroyed as a result of the police raid, which was authorized by Mayor Michael Bloomberg. Salim Rizvi, FSRN, New York City.
Internet retail giant Amazon dropped their support of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, today. The announcement came as activists marched outside the company's shareholder meeting in downtown Seattle. Protests have been happening all week, organized by the economic justice group Working Washington. The group also says the meeting was cut short as a group inside demanded that Amazon pay its fair share of taxes. The city of Los Angeles has banned the use of plastic grocery bags, making it the largest city in the country to enact such an ordinance. Following a year-long phase-out period, businesses will also be required to charge 10 cents per paper bag. The city council overwhelmingly approved the measure. Nearly 50 cities in California have similar bans in place. The Colorado ACLU says domestic violence survivors in western Colorado are now facing deportation proceedings, and the group says more cases will arise now that a new federal immigration program has taken effect in the state. For FSRN, Hannah Lee Myers reports from Boulder.
Until now, Colorado state law gave local authorities discretion in when they could pass information to federal authorities in domestic violence cases. Under that provision, many counties waited until a conviction was secured. But the ACLU says officials in western Colorado's Garfield County have been using the allowed discretion to report domestic violence victims. The group reviewed the cases of several undocumented women, victims of serious domestic violence, who were arrested after going to local law enforcement. In each case, all charges against the victims were dismissed. Yet because Garfield County automatically reported to ICE at booking, the women were placed in deportation proceedings. Now the ACLU fears this practice could become widespread. This week, Colorado enacted the Secure Communities Program. Now everyone arrested, regardless of whether they are ultimately convicted, must be reported to U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Hannah Lee Myers, FSRN.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
Thank you to Free Speech Radio for that, those international headlines. More headlines and their full newscast can be found on their website, fsrn.org. And now we go to Democracy Now!, where Amy Goodman interviews Sharif Abdel Kudus, who's an independent journalist and reporting from Cairo in Egypt, where the people of Egypt recently held their first presidential elections.
For the second day in the country's first competitive presidential election following the ouster of Hosni Mubarak 15 months ago. Authorities have declared today a public holiday to allow public sector workers to vote. Results are expected within the next few days. If no candidate wins above 50% of the vote, a runoff between the top two contenders is scheduled for June 16th.
Democracy Now! Correspondent Sharif Abdel Kudus spent yesterday traveling to polling stations around Cairo, speaking to voters about their choices for president and their concerns in the election. He filed this report.
Election day in Egypt. Millions of voters head to the polls in the country's first ever competitive presidential race. 15 months after 30-year autocrat Hosni Mubarak was forced out of office in a popular uprising, the people of Egypt are deciding who will replace him.
Well, actually, this is the very first time in Egyptian history since pharaohs and so on that we do vote for our president.
But with the enthusiasm comes anxiety as well. The Supreme Council of Armed Forces has led the country through a turbulent transition, and many questions remain about the military's future role. The president is being elected without a constitution and without clearly delineated powers. Yet for the first time in history, the outcome of Egypt's presidential election is not a foregone conclusion, and it's anyone's guess who will win. Among the leading frontrunners is the Muslim Brotherhood's candidate, Mohamed Morsi. This man says he supports Mohamed Morsi because he will enact Sharia law and has an Islamic political program. Last fall, the Muslim Brotherhood captured more than 40% of the seats in parliamentary elections. Yet some of those who supported the group the first time round are not backing them for the presidency.
I voted for the Brotherhood in the first phase in the parliamentary elections. I can't vote for the Brotherhood now. I am saying my personal opinion. Why? Because we need to have a collection of people in government, Brotherhood and liberals and so on. That is what the Egyptian people are, the different communities we have. I voted for Hamdi Sabahi because he's a moderate. He has no pressures. He wants to serve the Egyptian people.
Also among the frontrunners are two former members of the Mubarak regime, Amr Musa, who served as Mubarak's foreign minister for 10 years, and Ahmed Shafiq, who was his last prime minister. Voters cited their experience in the former government as reasons to back them. This man says he's voting for Amr Musa because he spent his whole career in foreign diplomacy and understands how to deal with the country. Ahmed Shafi understands politics and can bring the country forward, says this voter. Outside another Imbeba polling station, this woman says the incoming president should focus on what poor people want, a life of dignity. Fellow voters nearby not in agreement. But when she says she voted for Ahmed Shafiq, they burst into a heated argument.
All of the crises the woman said I agreed with, except for Ahmed Shafiq. He is a part of the former regime. Ahmed Shafiq is Mubarak, and Mubarak is Ahmed Shafiq. The man is sticking his tongue out at us. He says he is Mubarak's representative. I vote by exclusion. I exclude Ahmed Shafiq and Amir Musa, and then any one of the 11 left. Any one of them. Personally, I support Mohamed Morsi, but if Abdel Monaim Abdel Fattah came, I would be happy. If Hamdim came, I would be happy. If Khalid Ali came, I would also be happy.
Here in Imbeba, as people line outside of school to go into the polling station, some of the main issues of concern are the economy and security. But some of those who took part in protests in Tahrir Square are calling for a deeper change.
There are people who are against change, people who are against Egypt moving forward, people who are against a certain idea prevailing. People say, damn the revolution, that the revolution ruined the country. The revolution made people go down believing in someone. It doesn't matter who. What matters is that people went down to choose someone. The revolution made people think politically. My dad is 60 years old. He never thought politically in his entire life. Now he studies what is good, what is bad. There is awareness. It's like there was an electric shock that made people think. There's something called the economy, the state, security. The revolution made people rise up and open their eyes.
Revolutionary graffiti covers the walls of downtown Cairo. One of them showing the former president Hosni Mubarak and Field Marshal Hussein Tantawi, and behind them two members of the former regime who are running for president today, Amr Musa and Ahmed Shafiq. This on the corner of the square that is considered the epicenter of the revolution, Tahrir. But some of the revolutionaries who are at the core of this struggle that caused these elections to happen are boycotting today. One of them is Pierre Soufi.
I'm not voting today because I have a problem with voting in a without a constitution, voting without knowing what the president is going to come and do. What can he do? I mean, what are his responsibilities? So I'm not voting. I have no idea why should anybody vote. I mean, the whole story is just picking a puppet to put and whoever the puppet is not going to make any difference, I think.
A puppet to who?
A puppet to the military institution. It's not even anymore the SCAF itself, it's the military institution as a whole.
The neighborhood of Shubra lies just north of Tahrir Square. It's home to more than 3 million residents, including the largest concentration of Copts, Egypt's Christian minority. Residents spoke about their concerns on election day.
اخترت مرشح مدني علشان انا شايف ان هو ده يصلح انه يكون رئيس جمهوريه.
I chose a civil candidate because I saw that he would fit to be your president. I think that the most important thing in the country is that there is some justice, because there is a lot of sectarian racism because of religion and class differences. That's why no one gets their rights in the country. So we need someone who is not partial to a specific religion.
Another Shubra resident explained why he was backing Amr Musa.
He is the most preferable because he is a civil man. He is not from the military or the Brotherhood. The Brotherhood say things and then go back on their word. They said they only wanted some of parliament, but look how much they took. When it is a civil country, I will feel that it is not military nor Brotherhood, so I will be at peace.
Just across the river from Shubra is the upper-scale neighborhood of Zamalek. Voters here also voice concerns about the rise of Islamist politics in post-Mubarak Egypt.
I don't want our leader to be someone who is biased or have any preferences. I want someone who is a representative of the Egyptian culture and the simple Egyptian mentality, who can represent and give minorities as well as majorities their rights. And someone who does not invest his time in things that are, at the end of the day, very private. Just for me, that is religion.
It is necessary I vote for Amr Moussa because he has long experience in international, regional, and Arab diplomacy. He is a man of the world and understands the administration of a country's affairs. It's possible to say he can balance between political Islam that is ruling our legislative branch in the People's Assembly and the Shura Council.
Abdelmenam Ebel Fattouh is another Islamist candidate who has gained support from across the political spectrum, from secular liberals to conservative Muslims. Tariq Hamdi says he's voting for him to reject the Muslim Brotherhood's candidate.
Let's say it's a strategic vote because I think, honestly, the 13 candidates are not the best. We are choosing the best of the worst, if we may say so. So in this case, definitely, I believe from the studies I have made and the people I have talked with that he has the biggest chances.
Other voters are backing Hamdin Sabahi, a longtime opponent of the Mubarak regime and the founder of a Nasserist political party.
He's the only revolutionary candidate. We're definitely not voting for the old regime, and we're definitely not voting for the people vocaling religious state. So the only candidate available for that option is Hamdi Sabah. I have very low hopes of the whole process. I see it as non-democratic. I see that the transformation has been deformed by the SCAF. The whole transformation has been built wrong. We should have had a constitution before a president and elections. We're going to face this month first phase of elections, second phase of elections, the court order for Mubarak, the handover of authority that we're clearly seeing signals of the military establishment not willing to transform this authority to a civilian rule. We're looking at a very tense month that can be extremely explosive. Hopefully it passes the right way, it passes the revolution way, it passes the way that serves the people the best.
Vote tallying in Egypt's presidential election begins today, shortly after the polls close. Speculation is rife over whom will come out on top. If no candidate wins more than 50%, a likely runoff will be held next month, with the final result announced on June 21st. For the winner, a turbulent future awaits. For Democracy Now!, I'm Sherif Abdul Quddus with Hani Mas'oud in Cairo, Egypt.
Thank you to Democracy Now! And that interview with Sharif Abdul Quddus, a reporter. Thank you to Democracy Now! For that interview with Sharif Abdul Quddus, an independent journalist reporting from Egypt. And now we go back to Free Speech Radio News for their in-depth coverage of headlines around the world.
In Western Sudan, more than 100,000 people face a lack of basic health care as vital medical supplies and personnel are blocked from reaching North Darfur. Doctors Without Borders said restrictions imposed by Sudanese authorities have forced them to suspend nearly all of their services in the area. Government authorities cite insecurity. As the rainy season approaches, medical teams say the suspension puts people at risk for the spread of disease and prenatal and maternal deaths. For more, we're joined by Alberto Cristina, program manager for Doctors Without Borders in Sudan. He joins us from Barcelona. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you.
First, talk about the restrictions from the Sudanese government. Why are you suspending operations in the Jebel Sea region of North Darfur State?
So the main reason of this situation is that local authorities did not allow us to send this usual drug supply, logistic supply. And this is not the only problem we are facing. Another one is the impossibility for our international medical human resources to get the normal, the usual travel permission from the local authorities. And all these two things combined have been forcing us to reduce our activities very close to zero.
One hospital, five health posts, as you mentioned, difficulty with supplies and personnel getting there. How many people are affected by this lack of services, and who are they?
Around 100,000 people. I have to add that we can also consider another 10,000 nomadic population that are passing through the area in specific timing of the year. So we are talking about more or less 110,000 people completely left without any kind of medical offer. And we are particularly worried for the under five. During the year, they are affected by malnutrition, and pregnant women that are not able to receive proper antenatal care and proper cesarean section in case of need.
Well, with this cutoff of services there, some 110,000 people, as you mentioned, especially vulnerable women and very young children, what are their alternatives to the services offered by Doctors Without Borders? Where can they go?
The people have to travel more than 8 hours with private transportation in order to join the closest hospital in the capital of North Darfur, El Fasher. And the situation is getting worse and worse. You can also imagine that during the rainy season, just now, the malaria impact will be or could be very dramatic on this population that has been left without any kind of medical services.
Alberto Cristina is program manager with Doctors Without Borders in Sudan. More than 100,000 people are without basic medical services in North Darfur State. Alberto Cristina, thank you for the update.
Thank you for calling me.
This weekend, the Republic of Azerbaijan hosts the Eurovision Song Contest. It's a flashy, colorful pageant in which more than 40 countries compete in front of an international television audience of around 125 million people. The oil-rich former Soviet Republic of 9 million is using the event to show off its wealth, but the limelight has also brought scrutiny to a country plagued by endemic corruption and rampant human rights violations. FSRN's Jacob Resnick reports from the capital city, Baku.
Baku is a city that's grown quickly since the collapse of the Soviet Union. Independent Azerbaijan has been on a building spree with boulevards, hotels, and skyscrapers. Watchdogs say the country has spent hundreds of millions of dollars on a venue called Crystal Hall, built for this year's week-long Eurovision Song Contest. Contestants are rehearsing for the pageant, which is carried live on more than 40 channels across Europe. The international audience casts votes by text messages on their cellular phones. Azerbaijan's contestants won last year in Germany, giving it the right to host this year's pageant. But this honor has had a human cost. Ahead of the contest, the government forcibly evicted dozens of families and demolished their homes, sometimes destroying their belongings too. This continues a pattern in which the government has displaced ordinary people for the sake of development. Human rights advocates say the country also restricts freedom of expression and assembly, cracking down on political activists and journalists. Georgi Gogia, Human Rights Watch's senior researcher in the South Caucasus, says Eurovision is an opportunity for scrutiny.
One thing Azerbaijan really cares about is its international prestige. And Azerbaijan leadership has made a lot from hosting this Eurovision Song Contest. They were showing to the international world and international community the rich culture and history of this country. Of course, there's nothing wrong with this. This is great. However, what Azerbaijani authorities have not calculated or miscalculated is that such media attention also means that the problems that the country has, including on human rights front, are exposed also for the scrutiny.
The country is ruled by President Ilham Aliyev, who inherited the reins of power from his father, President Haydar Aliyev, who died in office in 2003. In response to criticisms, senior officials here are unapologetic. Here's Ali Hasanov, a senior presidential administration official, reacting to questions about his government's human rights record.
There are organizations such as Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch which are harming and insulting Azerbaijan's international image. We know their agenda and their power in the world, but nevertheless, the people of Azerbaijan and also our media are losing confidence in these organizations.
Azerbaijan's investment in this year's Eurovision is unprecedented. Hasanov said spending on the Crystal Hall venue cost more than $60 million, but the cost could be much higher. According to an independent audit by the Public Association for Assistance to Free Economy, the public interest think tank examined the orders for spending and said the Crystal Hall venue actually cost the country $278 million, with the total cost for the whole event topping $800 million. That's an absurd amount of money for any country to spend, warns economist Zurab Ismail, who prepared the audit.
Right now, Azerbaijan has a lot of money from oil sector, but after 10, 50 years, it will finish, and Azerbaijan government has to solve current problems like development of private sector, but not use a lot of money for big projects. It is very dangerous for future of Azerbaijan.
But can a country really spend nearly $1 billion on a song and dance pageant? The answer is not really, say journalists here. Much of the money is disappearing through graft and corruption, funneled by subcontractors with direct ties to the ruling family. Earlier this year, investigative reporter Khadija Ismailova revealed these ties while reporting for Radio Free Europe. She recalls what soon followed, an anonymous parcel with photos and a threatening letter warning her to back off.
The pictures were showing me engaged in sexual relations with my boyfriend in my bedroom. And it was clearly hidden camera work. So while I went public, I made an announcement that it's not going to stop me. And I'm not ashamed of anything. Those who are stealing people's money should be ashamed.
So as pop stars from around Europe take the stage, with millions of viewers tuning into the primetime spectacle, rights groups and opposition figures say they hope the new attention will help their cause. But without democratic reform, the great oil and gas wealth of this small country, wedged between Russia and Iran, will remain in the hands of a dynastic ruling family, with democracy firmly out of reach. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Baku, Azerbaijan.
Welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM. Thank you to Free Speech Radio News for those international segments. And now we go to an editorial where we talk about a recently proposed Bill C-31. Claire?
So Bill C-31 is basically being proposed by Jason Kenney, the immigration minister in Canada. And it's regarding the health care for refugees in Canada. So basically what it's suggesting is to make significant cuts to the interim federal health care program, which people are worried is going to result in many refugees in Canada losing their access to primary health care services and medications to treat illnesses. So essentially, this means that a lot of refugees are not going to have coverage for prenatal care or even coverage treatment for very basic primary care things. And the government's logic for this is that these cuts are necessary to just save taxpayer money. But then at the same time, I think by ignoring that basic primary care, they're forcing these situations to escalate into emergency care. And I think it's pretty basic economics that if you put a little bit of money at the beginning to in primary care to stop that, so you're going to be saving a lot of money in emergency health care. And the other argument they have is that these are fair because Canadians don't get medications covered by the federal government, but of course most Canadians either have insurance, extended health care benefits from work, or social assistance. And right now what the federal health program offers, it's coverage similar to that on provincial social assistance. So refugees right now are currently not receiving more resources than those at the lowest end of our economic spectrum. Mm-hmm. So once it is taken away, they're going to be even below that. And I don't think that's the kind of message we want to be sending to our refugees or about our health care system in general.
Mm-hmm. And the argument that preventive care is so much cheaper than actually dealing with emergencies is very true. I remember when they were having the health care debates in the United States, they were talking about the cost to give medication that prevent a heart attack, like Lipitor or something like that, like preventative medicine, can be less than half of the cost when it's given, when it's passed on to the government,
right,
of an actual heart attack. So if someone has a heart attack, comes to the ER, the amount of money it costs you just in the ER, not even post care, would be astronomically higher than actually providing that person with the preventative measures needed to prevent that from ever happening. So I guess the economic argument is there, and also it could go to Canada's fairly, it could tarnish Canada's fairly good record around the world and being a place where refugees come, where immigrants come, and like that's something that's very much ingrained in the way Canada has been seen and how Canadians feel about the country over the last 50 years.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I said that it's only going to cover urgent or essential medical care, and so basically supplementary benefits, so-called, such as medications, dental care, vision care, ambulance services, and stuff like that are all going to be gone. And I think these, like you said, they're all very essential. And I mean, under this new program, someone can get diagnosed with diabetes, and then they won't be able to actually get insulin to treat it. Mm-hmm. So I think the fact that a lot of doctors are actually up in arms about this, a lot of physicians who do deal with, especially people who are refugees or recent immigrants, and a lot of these people have really been speaking up about this, and they've been protesting to Ottawa and in Toronto. I think the fact that these doctors who obviously very much deal with these situations day to day are so up in arms about it, I think it's really, it's obviously a call to alarm for most citizens, and we really need to take a stand against this.
Right, so it's pretty obvious that since the doctors are up in arms about it, do we know anything about how these laws come into effect? Like, do they discuss these with doctors, or do they just come up with it out of the blue and in defense of some sort of patriotic sense of defending healthcare?
I mean, I believe this bill came as a partially, at least, well, this is kind of a shot in the dark. This is how most, a lot of these bills decide to come about are more cost-cutting measures,
right,
than actual social policy. So it might be far less about refugees don't deserve healthcare,
right,
and more about kind of deficit hawks going through the books and seeing ways in which they can cut spending, and then maybe going back and justify it, be like, well, we should cut spending here, and we can do it here because of this reason. Mm-hmm. But the main motivation behind it is to spend less.
And I think that's understandable as well, given like the budgetary situations and the fact that like with the global recession and everything, I mean, it is understandable that cost cutting does have to happen. And every time there's cost cutting to a social program, obviously people are upset. But I do think this one sort of crosses that line and goes from like sensible cost cutting that's painful to something that just seems completely senseless.
Yeah, because these are two issues that Canadians for many years have felt very strongly about. Have been Canadian healthcare system, obviously people admit there's many issues in Canadian healthcare system and things need to be resolved, but the idea that everyone does deserve access to medicine, and also Canada's stance on immigration. And I think even if you read the Globe and Mail at all for the past, I'd say, 2 weeks, they've had front page editorial series on how Canada needs to increase immigration, how immigration is a very important part. It's actually been a very big push from sectors that don't normally talk about immigration into promoting Canadian immigration policy.
Yeah.
Right. Well, we will keep you updated on Bill C-31 as it progresses through the Parliament. The legislature. Yeah, yes. All right. So that does it for our program here on News 101. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, please contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast, listen to our latest interviews on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us on Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Claire Eagle. Today's show is produced with love by Iqbal Ahmed. From the entire news team here at CITR, thank you for listening. Enjoy your weekend and stay tuned for Stranded right here on CITR 101.9 FM.